Hello, welcome back to the podcast. It's great to have you here. It is the 29th of February 2020 when I'm recording this, and I've just parked up. I've just had a really interesting conversation with Patrick Johnston. Now, Patrick is best known for having written Operation World, which is an amazing book which lists all of the countries in the world and ways that Christians can be praying for that particular country. It's been through many editions. It's now in its seventh edition, and it's been translated into a number of different languages. It's been translated into German, Spanish, Portuguese, French, Korean, Chinese, Russian, Indonesian. Parts of it have been translated into Italian. In total, all of these editions, it's been printed over 2 million times, and it's an incredible resource for Christians. And the originator of this book is Patrick Johnston, and he is the most lovely man, incredibly humble and gentle, and happens to go to my church. So he's a great person to talk to. He's had an amazing life, and I just sat down with him to talk about his walk with God and how that's changed things for him. How long have you got? 40 minutes or so?
Yeah. Robin went out shopping.
Oh, right, okay.
And so she thought she'd be out of the way.
Oh,
because okay. We don't have, I mean, otherwise we'd go up to my office.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is also possible, but it's quite crowded, which is a sort of half bedroom.
You're right, okay.
Anyway, so now, I wanted to ask a few questions about you, but it's a bit early for that.
Go for it.
You told me something of your background.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten it already, but it was something interesting in Christian ministry.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in a Christian household, very loving Christian household. My parents, I remember kind of from an early age, I remember them sort of making sandwiches for homeless people that had come to the door, and you know, all these things, sort of memories from childhood. And I think for me, I just have a sense of that time as being a really good time. You know, I was so blessed to have a happy childhood, because a lot of people don't have that, unfortunately. And I was, really blessed to have that. I went to church. Growing up, we would say grace at dinner. You know, that would be part of the furniture almost, and it was a really beautiful thing. But I guess, like anyone who grows up in a Christian household, there has to be a point where you either declare that this is now your own faith, that you believe that Jesus lived and died and rose for us, or you walk away from it. And that's the other sad thing that happens to a lot of people who grow up in Christian families. And I think I went to university. I left home when I was 18, and at that time, I just found that I was drifting away quite subtly at first, but I was just drifting away from my Christianity almost. Yeah. I wasn't going to church. I sort of, at the beginning of university, I tried a few churches out, but quite half-heartedly, to be honest, it has to be said. I didn't really invest in it, and just found that I was drifting away from it, and as a result of that, found myself quite restless almost, and trying to find meaning in lots of different things. I became at that time very political, very interested in sort of left-wing politics and all of that sort of stuff, and really tried to find meaning in that, and just wasn't quite satisfied with that. I graduated, and I came to Derby, and I think I was quite keen when I moved to Derby that I would find a church, because I realised it had been something that had been sort of lacking from my time at uni. And I stumbled upon the church that we both go to, and was just really struck by firstly how international it was, how there were people
worshipping the same God, who had come from all corners of the world, and how kind of multi-generational it was as well. I think those were the two things, big things for me, that were really really exciting. And through that kind of process of hearing the gospel afresh almost, and almost going back to basics with things, I really chose to give my life to Christ at that at that moment. So that was three or 4 years ago, and have been I mean, in a sense, I've been walking, well, God's been walking with me since day one, and you know, it's been part of my life for all my life, really. But I would say for me personally, that kind of that revelation came three and a bit years ago.
Brilliant.
And I mean, I can I ask the same question to you?
Yes,
where did it all begin? Where did it begin for you?
Well, I was so different.
Okay.
Because my family weren't active Christians at all. I went through the usual rigmarole of the Anglican Church. I was christened. I went to a public school, hated it, and was confirmed there. But I remember the confirmation sermon well. He slew a lion in a pit on a snowy day, was the preacher. And that's what he preached on in that passage in the Old Testament. But I still was not a Christian. But God spoke to me about serving him in Africa. And that terrified me. I didn't know what that all meant. And so I even said to some of my friends, I said, I think I'll be a missionary one day. And it was crazy. And but then I went through a terrible experience just after I'd left the school, doing very badly, incidentally, in my A-levels, because I had such a low estimation of myself. My voice didn't break until I was 16, so I felt so unable to compete with my peers.
Right.
And very humiliating, and all the wrong compensating methods you get. And so, but one was keeping your head below the parapet. And so I just kept out of trouble, but I didn't get much in A-levels. I just scraped one A-level. But then we went on holiday in Cornwall, and we went to Tintagel, which is that medieval castle and pre to that. And there's a little cove there, and we went swimming. And my father just had a big, serious operation, and he swam more than he should have done. And he went to the mouth of the cove, and there were big breakers there, and I think he tried to get out onto a shelving rock there, but a wave took him, smashed his snorkel, and he drowned. And so there was I, 18, lost my father in drowning, five siblings all younger than me, and my mother just 40. And it was a massive crisis for the family. Our house, the house wasn't ours, it was my grandfather's, and he was still around. And so within a few months, we had to leave the house, very little money, and it was tough. But the fact of my father dying like that forced me to think of where am I going in life. I actually went to a local tech and did my A-levels again and did really well, because I really had an earnestness about life now, because I felt a degree of responsibility as the oldest in the family. And but then I went to university at Bristol to do chemistry, and in my second term I was standing in the queue to register for the term for my grant, for the sake of my grant, which we then had, and in front of me was a guy who'd been at my old school, and I saw his tie. He had the old boy's tie on. And so I started speaking with him, and he turned out to be a theological student at what is now Trinity in Bristol. And he invited me along to his room, and I went along, and basically he led me to the Lord and discipled me. And he got me involved in the Christian Union, in early Christian ministry, and did Bible study with me, and did a really good job in discipling. And so that got me on the road. I now had an answer to what life was about, and also that niggle that God had spoken to me about going to Africa. But then in our Christian Union, there was a guy living in Bristol who represented a little mission called the Dorothea Mission, which hardly exists today. It's a South African mission that worked in the slums of Southern Africa. And he came to our Christian Union and showed slides of the work, and I knew that's where God wanted me. And shortly after that, a guy proposed to my mum. He took on the task of six kids. And he was a great, lovely guy. And so he was a great stepfather and really positive. But it then meant that I was freer to do what I wanted to do and what God was, I believe, calling me to do. But my mother then consulted with us all individually, is it all right if I marry Jeff? And we all said, yes, that's fine. But then I felt free to share with my mum that I believe God wanted me to go to Africa. And she didn't understand all that talk. So for years after that, she was convinced I'd gone to Africa because I disapproved of her marriage. As if I'd punish myself.
Yeah. That's quite extreme, isn't it?
I know.
That was the case.
And anyway, eventually I think she got reconciled to it. But then I went out to Africa in 1962 and started my career in Africa. And really, there were so many things I had to learn. And God was good to me. I mean, I knew I'd been saved. I had lots of Bible teaching and so on, but I went to a Bible school in South Africa, and by the time I'd finished, I'd learned two other languages, which was helpful, and most of the lectures were in Afrikaans, so I had to learn Afrikaans quickly, and I learned a lot of Zulu. But one of the rules we had in the mission was that we could not marry for 6 years, and that applied to us all, Africans, Westerners too. And that was tough because actually just before I left England, I was in a friend's house in Essex, because I lived in Essex then. A friend said to me, oh, I've heard about somebody else who is also going out with the Dorothea Mission. Oh, I hadn't sort of cottoned on to that. And but I can remember in the room where I was standing, and God hasn't spoken to me, almost like with a voice, but so real, more than a few times in my life. But that was one of them. And God said to me, that's going to be your wife. How do I handle this, you know? Well, I just put it on the back burner. I didn't know her name. I didn't know how old she was. I didn't know what she looked like. I knew nothing, except that she was going out to the same mission. Well, she indeed followed 6 months later. And I remember so clearly where we met. And it's a very strange experience to see a woman for the first time and know immediately that's going to be my wife. She was lovely. I mean, that wasn't a problem. She was just a year older than I, and a nurse, and lovely. But I had to wait 6 years.
And you managed to
stay true to that? Yes, I did.
Wow.
I did. There were a lot of people tried to match us up because it was obvious that we would fit. But
had the two of you had those discussions at all?
No, I didn't want to even mention it.
Really?
Because if I mentioned it or gave a hint, it would make our relationship. I couldn't just treat her like one of the other young ladies in the mission, you know, banter and talk, the occasional times we were able to meet. But I could just treat her like another sister. And, I mean, she began to have feelings, but she didn't dare let them go because I hadn't given any indication. But by then I was working up in Zimbabwe. And so we'd only see several days in a year thereafter. Eventually, I got permission to contact her. And so we met up, and of course it all went through, and we got married after 6 years. I mean, one of the great things of the Little Dorothea mission was its emphasis on winning people for Jesus and prayer. And 3 months after I landed in South Africa, the leader of the mission asked me if I would go and organise a prayer conference in the Eastern Cape in South Africa. And he gave me a voluntary helper in the mission to be my gopher. And so off we went, and we did it, and it really went well. And in a sense, it sort of set another ministry course in my life. And it's just amazing to me how God works, because, you know, it takes very silly, ordinary people with all their hang-ups and difficulties and equips them. I mean, there was a time when I had to take part in a debate at school. I had to second a motion. I remember sitting in the gymnasium where we had this big debate. And I'd prepared something, but then when I saw all the people, I panicked and I just forgot everything. And I just messed it up. And it was so embarrassing. And I said basically, I was 17 then, I'll never be involved in anything that involves public speaking. And I hated French, having to learn French. And I'll never be involved in something that involves learning another language. And I'll never teach. And all of those I did.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it, how God uses us in ways that we could never exactly. even... If we were strategizing this, we would never think, okay, I'm going to do this.
But then even more than that, he actually gives us enjoyment in doing what we thought we could right. never do. And anyway, so I ended up in a preaching mission, and I've been preaching all my life. And then learning languages. I'm now trying to learn a bit of Farsi. Mm. So that's my 20th language to try and 20th. Learn.
Wow.
I've learned, my qualification for a language is if I've learned 2,000 words.
Okay, and that's enough to have a fairly good
well, you can understand a lot of what's going on in a limited way. You can have a conversation.
Yeah. But
in four, I've preached. Three, I've preached that I've learned apart from English, but English is the fourth. But with Farsi, I'm only about 400 or 500 words at the moment.
Keep plodding away. You'll get there, I'm sure.
But I mean, I must say, in our church with so many Iranians around,
it's a real blessing, isn't it?
I know. I would like. To have some lessons. I mean, one of the problems with Farsi, I've learned the alphabet and everything so I can read the Arabic script slowly. But one of the problems is that there are no, that you have to have special diacritics to show the weak vowels.
Mm.
A, A, E. You've got the A and the A and the E, you can, or the O and the E. And you can have a letter for. But the other short ones, there's nothing. So you don't know whether it's A or E or O.
Yes, I found the same because I was learning Arabic. And
yeah, exactly.
So they put the vowels on if you're teaching kind of children, don't
yes.
they? And that's what my teacher would kindly yes. do to me as well. She would put the, yes. the vowels in. But obviously, if you look at an Arabic or a Farsi newspaper, it's not going to have any of the vowels in because you would just
but
know
then,
them.
Then my question is, how do you know how to pronounce a word? And then you'd think there'd be dictionaries that would actually give the phonetics. And there's not one dictionary.
Oh, no. Just to make it difficult, Patrick.
I know. Anyway, but that's what I, but anyway, it's amazing how God does that. But anyway, I went out to Africa and almost immediately got involved in prayer conferences. That went so well, I was asked to go and do the same with another mission colleague to organise a prayer conference in Nairobi in Kenya. So off we went and we did that. But I realised with the gathering of people we had about 20 or 30 people, but we had so little information. So I then began to put together some prayer items of things I knew from around the world. It was just the way, what I'd picked up. But everybody was so grateful. They'd never seen anything like this before. That was in 1964. And when I got back to South Africa, I showed the leader of the mission what I had done. And he said, you must put this in a booklet. So we did, and he suggested a title for it, Operation World. And that was the start of that ministry. I didn't realise. I mean, I've got a few copies over there that I could show, but you can't show it on this. But
so the initial Operation World was, it was just a pamphlet?
Yes, kind of, yes.
Paperback. Look at this, here we go.
You have to edit out this.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, look at this. Wow.
See, this was the first one.
Wow, look at that. Amazing. So what year was this published?
That was 64.
Wow.
And
so I need to describe it for the listeners. So it's kind of a paperback, it's quite faded, sort of green booklet with a map of the world on the front. And
and it was done on a Gestetner machine.
Oh, okay.
You know, the Gestetner things.
Yeah, yeah.
With amazing. The wax paper.
Look at this.
And anyway, so after that had been in use for a few years, Hans von Staden, the leader of the mission, said, well, Patrick, you really ought to revise that. And I said, well, if I revise it, I'd really have to cover something of the other countries I didn't do in this one. And I didn't realise what I was saying. And so anyway, I started away. And but then I had another problem. I was then working in Zimbabwe, or Rhodesia, which was then under white rule, and sanctions were very rigid against the country. And I couldn't write to most countries of the world, and there were no libraries with the right kind of information I needed in the country. And so I had to use people in other countries to be postmen for me, to post them on, where I could send letters to. And one of them was Leslie Brierley, a missionary with WEC, the mission I now serve with. And he was then at the headquarters down in Buckinghamshire, newly acquired. And anyway, he was wonderful. He posted off the stuff, and then I was able to get enough information to produce this one.
Oh, okay, so it's a bit bigger.
A bit bigger now.
Yeah.
But then that we printed on our mission press in Pretoria.
Right.
But then we find with horror that we actually were not legally allowed to sell it. Because at that stage in South Africa, the printer unions had gained enough leverage that they insisted that no commercially sold book could be sold unless it was printed by union members. A closed shop arrangement, as they used to be called. And so we found we had to give the book away. And so I gave a copy to George Verver of OM and to Ralph Winter of the US Center over in California. And they were both hugely excited because nothing like it had ever been produced before. And so Ralph Winter immediately republished it under a different title in the States, just as it was. And George Verver then wrote several years later and said, Patrick, if you revise that, we and OM will take on the publishing of it. So they did. And that was the one before this one. What was this? No, yes, there was an orange one. And then, anyway, they then published it. And then it just went global.
Mm.
I don't know how many copies over the years and the seven editions have been published, but it's probably about 2.5 million.
Mm.
And so it has become one of the major components of the global missions movement. And especially with Koreans, Brazilians, with Portuguese, with Chinese, and so on. It's been the only source of information in their language that they could use to deploy their missionaries. And so the whole global missions movement took off a lot because of that information. So, you know, it, from just little beginnings, you just...
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And the idea that you can just pick it up and, you know, you can find some country, you know, Ghana, and you can just look at all the prayer points and be very specific in what you're praying for. I guess that's a resource that just didn't exist before this came along.
No.
So.
And so I don't know how many we'll find out, we'll never find out, but probably half the world's missionaries today, that book has had some influence in what they do and where they go. Jill then wrote a book. She wanted to write a book that would help children pray for the world. So she then wrote a book called You Can Change the World. And that had a huge impact on kids all over the world. For instance, I did a speaking tour of Northeast India 4 years ago. And we stayed in the house of a Christian family in Meghalaya, the state of Meghalaya, in Shillong, the wettest city in the world. Rainfall of about 400 inches a year, I think. In the monsoon, it just rains and rains. But anyway, but the daughter of the family was so excited because the husband of the lady who'd written that book for children was staying in her house.
Celebrity.
And, you know, she was then an adult, a young adult, but, I mean, she'd been brought up with that book. And that had happened to thousands of families all over the world. So Jill wanted to write that book, but she needed a co-worker because she was doing so much. She was the oil of the whole research office and part of our international team, and so she was key because I was traveling so much. She had to stay because of the children. And anyway, so we had a day of prayer and fasting for a co-worker. In the middle of the afternoon, the telephone rang, and it was a lady from California, and she said, "God has been speaking to me about working with you. Have you got a place?" What? We're just sort of praying for that. And it was one of the most dramatic answers to prayer. So she came and she joined the mission, worked with Jill for 2 years. But not long after she came, Jill's back broke. It was a secondary cancer, well, that's the first we knew. And so she lived for 2 years after that. We set her aside to finish the book. She finished her book a week before she died. But Robin was the lady. She then took a lot of Jill's work and did that. And then she went out to Turkey to prepare to work in Bulgaria amongst the Turkish speakers there. And then I messed things up by proposing to her 2 years after Jill died. And so that's how Robin came into my life.
Right.
So had wonderful answers to prayer too.
Yeah,
So that's that and...
It's quite a life, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Had a very exciting life.
Do you know how many countries you've visited at this point?
Sometimes when I lie in bed, I try and count. And, you know, it's where do you draw the line? I mean, I don't count countries where I've landed in the plane and not
just
left
seen
the
airport. Yes, yeah.
But countries I've preached in, I think it's in the high 50s.
Wow.
And,
Phenomenal.
And, but I've probably been in about 75 countries, I think. But I usually fall asleep by the time I've got around the world trying to count.
Yeah. And I guess just that travelling has given you a truly global perspective on the church as well.
Yes.
And expressions
yes.
of the church.
Yes.
And
that's right.
Yeah, how I guess a group of worshippers in South Africa is going to... It's going to look like a very different thing to
yes.
people in
yeah.
northern India.
That's right.
But actually, it's the same body of Christ.
Exactly.
And
the growth of the church in the world is so utterly different to what the media would seem to portray. I mean, I was just looking last night at a programme we were watching, speaking about Christianity in Britain at the time of the Romans. Oh, that religion spread quite a lot then. The person obviously speaking about Christianity as if it were a past thing, no longer relevant. And one of the chief editors at the time of The Economist, he wrote a book earlier this millennium, and he said if anyone, any politician, doesn't recognise the importance of religion in the 21st century, they've missed the boat. And he was a secular writer.
Mm.
And he's right. And we're now seeing it with 9/11 and all the things that have followed. Religion is a very key item on the world agenda, whether we like it or not.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking that the fastest growing church is in Iran? Or I guess it's hard to maybe quantify.
It's hard to quantify. I mean, I could say, for instance, that to the best of our ability to assess, in 1978, when the Ayatollah took charge, there were about 400 believers who'd come out of Islam in Iran. Today we don't know, but it may be anywhere between 500,000 and 1.5 million. And it's astonishing. And I mean, we're interviewing folk here who want to be baptized from amongst the immigrants. I would reckon half the Iranians have either come to Jesus in one of these underground churches, or they've been but not yet quite got through, but they had to flee because the group was broken up and leaders arrested by the secret police or the religious police. And so it's very hard. And in fact, one of the policies of the Iranian government is that if they find a group beginning, they say, you've got a choice. Either you stay and go to prison, or you just leave the country. They're hoping they can get rid of the Christians. So that's why we see so many Iranian Christians coming across the channel in boats.
Yeah.
Most of them are Iranian Christians.
Yeah.
And most people don't realise that.
I just know for me personally, meeting Iranians and hearing about their faith was so... so sort of humbling, but also just so exciting to hear that the way that they talked about God and the kind of beautiful relationship that they were describing with Jesus, and I just think, you know, in the media we often hear that the church is dying and that it's a thing of the past.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah. I would just love for these people to meet some of our friends at church who have literally left everything because of this faith.
Yes.
There we go. Thanks so much to Patrick for taking the time and for sharing some of his story with me. it was really great to hear from him, and I'm very grateful to him for giving me that time. Fab. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this, and I will speak to you again soon. As always, many thanks to Johnny Davies for creating the brilliant theme music, and to my brother Thomas as well for the jingles that you've been hearing throughout this podcast. I'm managing so far to release a new episode every other Friday, and I'm going to try and keep up with that rhythm, just to keep you in the loop with that. So until I next speak to you, I hope you have a wonderful time, and I'll speak soon. Okay, God bless.